He said that Phil said that if I gave the talk, if I gave the sex talk, I was supposed to say my name is Earl Marsh and I'm sexy. Get off the stage, will you? My name is Earl and I'm a drunk. It makes a lot of noise, doesn't it, huh? By Robert? We're talking about alcoholism now, aren't we? take that off the tape, will you? He says, I got into it and I can get out of it. We're still talking about alcoholism, aren't we? I'm an alcoholic, but he's sexy. Huh? Well, as long as you bow frontwards, yes, it's all right. Well, in 1955, we had the International AA Convention in St. Louis, and this was a very moving ceremony in which Bill turned over AA to the drunk. And up to that time, he and Bob had been, Bob now had died, but up to that time, he and Bob had been the main fountainhead of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it was there that the General Service Board and the General Service Conference came into legal being, and Bill, in his very magnificent way, stepped out of the picture legally and actually, and turned over his authority that he always had had, who else would have it now that Dr. Bob had died, to the General Service Board. And one of the members, first member of the General Service Board, was a guy named Ikey Sheridan. And Ikey Sheridan was from Texas. And he was one of the alcoholic members of the General Service Board. And that's when they had fewer alcoholic members than they had non-alcoholic. And after a big hassle, that's been reversed. But on the second night in St. Louis, 15 years ago, Ikey introduced Bill. And he told the following story, which is kind of typical of the alcoholic. He said down in East Texas, there was a little town, and they had no place to put a drunk if and when one came along. And they realized that one would very shortly. So until they could find better quarters, they would house a drunk in the ice house. And you know, in those days, they had ice houses, which are little green gadgets, you know, that sat on the street and you could come by and you could buy ice for a certain amount of money. And it's before they had the slot machines. And a man would go in and get a piece of ice out of the ice house and sell it. Sure enough, a drunk came along, and they put the little drunk in the green ice house. And that night, the sheriff was sitting at dinner, and suddenly he realized that he had left a drunk in the ice house. So he stood bolt upright and addressed his wife and said, "Oh, Emmy, I left old Joe down there in the ice house. We can't leave him all night. He'll be frozen stiff in the morning. I must go down and get him out." He put on his hat, walked down the little lane to the green ice house, and he came to it. He quickly opened the very heavy door, and as it creaked open, a ray of light crept into the darkened ice house, And over in that corner, amidst a series of big kegs of ice, huddled a little drunk, who looked up at the sheriff and said, "For God's sake, close that door. I'm freezing to death." And that's how Bill got introduced in St. Louis. I came in here today and someone said, "What are you going to give today?" And I said, "Well, I guess I'm going to give the blackboard talk." And he said, "Oh, no, not again." But I guess that's what I'm going to do, is give it again. And Bill said, as an encore, we could give the sex talk, but we won't do that today. Let me address my remarks to two statements. One is, how come that you and I have become alcoholics? How has this happened? Why isn't everyone, all the drinkers, why aren't all of the drinkers in the United States in the same trouble that you're acquainted with and that I'm acquainted with? Oh, my God, there's Gene. Hey, Gene, how are you? And the second question is, why is it that you and I can't take a drink again? Why is this? And barring a few doubts by some medical man, as far as is known, you and I, as alcoholics, cannot take another drink. Why is that? Why can't you and I drink again? And how come we got into this predicament? I'd like to address myself to those two remarks. Now, some of you have heard what I'm going to say, but I'm going to say it again. And that is that most authorities feel that alcoholism is a true physical disease, and that you and I suffer from what been medically called an error in metabolism. Now that means that we use alcohol or utilize, our body utilizes alcohol in a totally different way than does the non-alcoholic. Now, how come we do this? Well, no one really knows, but the famous authority, Bunky Jelinek, he was the great authority on alcoholism. He was in Stanford the last 5 years of his life. And he wrote the book, Alcoholism, the Disease. He said to me once that he felt that probably a little less than half, and he admitted this was guesswork, that a little less than half of the alcoholics are born with a certain metabolic bodily difference when compared to the non-alcoholic, and the other half of alcoholics, or maybe a little more than half, acquired this difference in some odd way. So no one really knows. So I'm going to address those two statements, how come you and I became alcoholics, and why we cannot take a drink once we have become alcoholics, in terms of some bodily difference that you and I possess. Now, if we had all of the authority, and there aren't too many, by the way, on this stage, on the treatment of alcoholism up here, we would find that there would be a few who would disagree with what I am about to say. They would say, "No, that's not true." And that's correct. We don't know the final chapter and how you and I became alcoholics and why we can't take another drink. Also, if we had the authorities here, they would say you can't make such a dynamic and definitive statement. And I don't mean to make any definitive statements today. It'll sound as though they're definitive, but they aren't. This is all a state of flux. We're all in a state of change about our ideas on alcoholism. But enough evidence has accumulated to indicate that you and I do not suffer predominantly from emotional difficulties which lead to alcoholism, but rather we have a physical upset in our body which leads to alcoholism. Now, why do I make those two comparisons? because we are just outgrowing the phase where every alcoholic was looked on as an emotional cripple. Now this, there's no question that we as alcoholics have many, many, many emotional problems. As a matter of fact, the problems that we have in some instances amongst our audience might have problems that are even greater than the alcoholic problems. This is true. But in general, alcoholics, when they're sober, handle their lives rather well. All of us as physicians in our offices see patients every day who have emotional problems that would put our problems as alcoholics to shame. And yet these people who have crippling problems can drink or not drink as they see fit. Why can't we? Well, it's said that we have in our body a series of physical differences which, for want of a better word, has been called the X factor. Now, that sounds kind of like I'm pulling your leg. But in medicine, we use the word X factor. For example, before we had the final story in diabetes, we said that the diabetic could not handle sugar in his body as compared to the non-diabetic, but didn't know why. We said it's because he had the X factor, which was a different setup to handle sugar. We now know some of those answers, so we don't use the name X factor anymore. We use the word insulin in terms of its amount. Same was true of pernicious anemia. Oh, lots of diseases we use. So the X factor is something in medicine uses. It isn't a gag. Now, what are these physical differences? Well, I can name a few of them. But before I do so, let's say this. Given the presence of an X factor, meaning a physical setup in you that's different when compared to the non-alcoholic, and if you add to that alcohol, you then get alcoholism. That's what happens. Now, what are some of these physical differences? Well, I'll just mention a few of them. I won't go into the technical biochemical differences because that wouldn't solve it. You'll just have to accept the fact that there are many biochemical differences. One of them is that we tend to have low blood sugar. I was sitting with my wife this morning. We're having some coffee, and she has no more sense than to be a drunk, too. She doesn't drink anymore. And she was kind of staring off into space, and she said, "I guess my blood sugar is low." And I didn't quite hear her because my blood sugar was low at the same time. Tests have shown that you and I do tend to run lower levels of blood sugar. Now, when this happens, we get a series of symptoms. We get fatigue. We're not as though the world were on our shoulders. Sometimes even get some tremulousness, shaking. Sometimes even get perspiring. All symptoms of that sort come to us, but certainly a sense of heaviness, a sense of not being with it, a sense of pressure on our shoulders. Also, the alcoholic has low blood pressure frequently, and this means a similar kind of symptom, a sense of heaviness in his head, a sense of as though a dull headache, a sense that you just can't put one foot in front of the other. Now, all people have these to some degree, but it's more common, a lowered blood pressure, apparently, in us than in the non-alcoholic. We don't get any credit for this. It's how many people have awakened in the morning, sober alcoholics, and just felt like death warmed over, and have got out the big book and read it and read it and read it and got out the grapevine and all the literature, and then in desperation have screamed, "I'm off the program. I just can't get it. I'm off the program. It's terrible. I just can't get it. It's awful. I should go to a meeting all the time. I can never get well," whatever that means. Well, if they jump up and down on one foot for a while and do a little exercise and maybe have a little something to eat, they'd find they'd feel a great deal better. So exercise early in the morning when you least want to do it is the best. And eating something when you're not hungry is the best in the morning. Well, anyway, there are some other findings. One is that I remember some amazing findings. There's less a baldness amongst alcoholics as compared to non-alcoholics. Now, this statistic, when I get up each morning and look in the mirror, I tend to doubt the statistic. But on the other hand, it's said that that alcoholics, as compared 1,000 to 1,000, that there's less baldness. There's also less obesity. There's less fatness. Now, we have fat alcoholics, but there's less of it, apparently, in the alcoholics. And also, our requirements for fluids are fabulous. You know, if a non-alcoholic came around to the average meeting of AA and saw the injudicious slurping of fluid, he would lose his mind. You know, we're always cramming something into our big yaps, you know. It might be orange juice, or it might be coffee, or tea, or Sanka, or water. And we just continue putting something. I'm not talking about booze. I just continue putting something. And one day, I was asked to address the American Academy of General Practice, and I was asked by Bill Marsh down here. He happens to be my father, you understand. He's a general practitioner and asked me to talk down there, so I did. On alcoholism, which is not my field, incidentally. I'm not interested in treating alcoholics, by the way. I don't think. And I mentioned the fact that there's less baldness, less obesity, and a great requirement for fluids, and all the other technical things. We went into a lot of technical aspects and so on. And the next day it came out in all the papers that I had said that if you're tall and you're thin and you've got a heavy head of hair and you're thirsty, look out. You know, that's kind of a thing. But it's true. Now, also, the muscle tension of alcoholics is greater than in non-alcoholics. They put cuffs around legs and arms and studied muscle tension. In alcoholics, it's higher amongst us than amongst non-alcoholics. You and I are destined to be tense forever. Now, if there's anyone here in this room who's trying to get untense, forget it. It's just like if anyone in this room is trying to get unresentful, forget it, you know. Is there anybody here in this room who never has any resentment? Would he or she raise his Christ-like hand? Isn't with us in this room here. I didn't see any hand. Oh, Ray raised his hand back there. Ray. he's talking to beginners anyway, you know. Then alcoholics are prone to intense activity or no activity. The blacks and whites in our activity is very common. We have few gray areas in between of reasonable activity. We struggle for this our whole lives, but we never make it. If anybody here is trying to become reasonable in his life or her life, forget it, because you can't make it. You just can't make it. You're all messed up. You're all angry. You're all smiling when you don't feel like it. You feel like hell. We all know this. You're resentful, trying not to be resentful. You're saying the Serenity Prayer 500 times a day. Now, anyone who has to say the Serenity Prayer 500 times a day is awfully resentful, you know. So let's just get it established that we love you as you're resentful. We love you as you're angry. We love you with all of your mess ups. And we also love it when you say, now that I've got the program and feel good, we know this is nonsense, but it's okay for you to say that. We know it. We know you're lying, you see, but that's perfectly all right. You know, the alcoholic will live next door to a non-alcoholic, and the non-alcoholic wife will say to the non-alcoholic husband, will you cut the lawn? Now, the non-alcoholic knows how to live life in a reasonable fashion. You know, it's a way of living that I wouldn't have for anything. But I'm here because I love being resentful and all messed up, my head twisted, you know. But the non-alcoholic knows how to kind of flow with things, you know. And he'll go out and cut the lawn. And then he has the capacity to notice a bird. He can stop and say, my, look at that bird fly. Isn't that beautiful? And he notices how the feathers rest on the wing. He savors this. He knows how he rides on the air current, you know. And then his wife has to come out and say, dear, come on, cut the lawn. I know you love the birds, but cut the lawn. And so he does. And then he sees a flower. And he notices how the petals rest, and then the beautiful transfer of one color to another, and its delightful aroma, you know. He'll even reach down and smell it, you know, and think, isn't nature wonderful, you know, and isn't it beautiful? And his wife will say, come on, cut the lawn. And so he does a little more. And then he meets a friend across the hedge. And the non-alcoholic has a capacity at times to be very friendly with his neighbor. We don't possess this capacity very much, you see, but he does, and so he talks to his friend, and rather laboriously, even very well, and with lots of fun, and with the birds and the flowers and the friends, he gets the lawn cut, and it takes him 2 or 3 hours, and it's been kind of pleasurable. Next door is the alcoholic, who is flat on his back, just flat on his back, and suddenly a flash occurs to him of cut the lawn. And he's likely to cut the lawn, he's back, flatten his back again. It's all done, just like that. Like that, you know. So, if you... You know. You see, we're talking to a bunch of drunks, and they know exactly what goes on. So, if you're trying to be reasonable, won't you please forget it, you know? Because we know you're lying, you see, it's all right. Now, there are many other things that compose this X factor, and I'm not going to go into them all. They're technical. There are different kinds of endocrines, for example, one known as aldosterone. Well, we'll forget that. In the history of alcoholics, by the way, as children, long before they ever had a drink, there's a history of the alcoholic. Let's say, as a child of 5 or 6, is present in my own history. When an anesthetic had to be given to have tonsils removed, all of the anesthesiologists know that the alcoholic requires much more anesthesia than does a non-alcoholic. And this requirement for sedatives, this requirement for large amounts in order to go to sleep, predates the first drink. That is, many alcoholics as children, before they ever had a drink, still require much, much anesthetic to go to sleep. Our tolerance for any kind of sedative is inherently high. My brother, who was 18 months younger than I, and is a professor at one of the universities over here, as a matter of fact, San Francisco State College, I'm sure you've heard of San Francisco State, he is not an alcoholic, and my uncle, who was a physician, an ear, nose, and throat, I had two uncles, ear, nose, and throat physicians, took out both of our tonsils. And it's a historical note in our family how much anesthetic I required and how much hell I raised. While my brother just went to sleep on a very little bit and had his tonsils taken out and woke up and did things in kind of a groovy way. But I didn't. I kicked the walls out and took a lot of anesthetic. So this is common. I won't go into any more of this. The point is that there seems to be a physical factor in you and in me which either we're born with or in some odd way we acquire as life goes along. So just accept that if you will. Now, everyone drinks to release tension. See, we're tense, we drink, and tension drops off. Another interval, we get tense, last for a while, we drink, and it drops off. Now, all people drink to decrease tension. Everybody does. It makes life, you know, it's said, you know, tongues loosen up. It's said that the inhibitions of life are alcohol soluble. You know, it just makes the inhibitions just crumble. So that everyone drinks to have tensions drop off earlier. That's why cocktail parties, you know, they go to cocktail parties, we all have done this, to decrease tension, so the tension drops off earlier than it would ordinarily if left to its own resources, like that. Now, that's true of the non-alcoholic, but oddly, the alcoholic, when he takes his first drink, something rather remarkable happens. His tension drops off as though he had been on the tail end of an atom bomb. It's as though something, the heavens had opened, and God had opened his arms and said, "This is my son or daughter, whom I am justly proud. Here's a fifth," you know. And so the alcoholic gets a fabulous release in tension. Wow! This is something. Why didn't somebody tell me about this before? You know, that kind of a thing. Now, this doesn't mean that many alcoholics like the taste of alcohol. Many, many do not. But I didn't particularly, because the taste is kind of equivocal. I like the burning sensation that would go all the way down, kind of like this, and then would land down here in my eyes. I kind of like that thing. But most alcoholics, not all, drink for the effect, you know, but it does something for us, you see. And it does something for the non-alcoholic, but not that much. So you and I secretly determine, I got to get back to that thing again. So we do. We go back to it again because our motivation is high. Alcohol does a lot for us. Then what happens is, as would happen in anybody, when we take more and more and more alcohol into our body, because the X factor demands it and our release from tension requires it, we build up even a greater tolerance to this sedative known as alcohol. And after all, alcohol is a sedative, it's a depressant. So the more you drink, and the more I drink in the course of our lives, each day that we drink, the more we drink, the more we have to drink. That means that on this given day of drinking, we require that much alcohol now to get the same effect that this much used to give us. And every day that we drink, it's a little bit more that we must have. Because this tolerance goes up. Just to add a little parenthetical note, in the end of the game, the tolerance tends to drop off. But that's way down at the end of the game. Now, the reason I don't pay too much attention to that is to make it possible to share with you the following statement. And that is that 97% of alcoholics are alcoholics who have assets. Homes, wives, cars, jobs, and so forth, and only 3% of alcoholics are on Skid Row. Only 3%. Most alcoholics will never see Skid Row except as they drive through Skid Row in their Cadillac convertible. Most alcoholics are living next door to you and me. Now, this is getting to be more and more true. That the alcoholic is this group is a forgotten group, because even now the American public still thinks, and even in this audience I'll bet there are a lot of people who still have the mental idea that a person is an alcoholic only if he's lying in the gutter, only if he's lost everything, only if he's broke, only if he's panhandling, only if he's shaggy. And this is just incorrect. It's not true. Now, years ago in AA, we attracted people who had lots of trouble. So it got so that everyone thought that in AA there were just a bunch of bums. Well, we may be a bunch of bums, don't you know? But I've even heard people say who were drinking too much and in trouble, "Good God, I'd sober up before I'd go to that organization." Well, that's all we want them to do anyway. But, you know. 97% of alcoholics are living next door to you and me. And you know, we used to have a gag in AA that most people thought they had fooled their friends about their drinking, and then they sobered up only to find out that they had not fooled their friends at all. We no longer can say that. Most alcoholics who are coming into AA today are coming in at a far earlier stage and indeed have fooled their friends. Most of their friends did not know that they were drinking and were in trouble because the symptoms are so minor. In other words, the public is getting some of the message. The age of people coming into AA is far less. It's somewhere in the 30s. It used to be in the 40s and at one time in the 50s. So people have been exposed to less alcohol, and they know more about it. Marty Mann and the National Council on Alcoholism, plus the activities of AA, have done a remarkable amount in acquainting people with the symptoms. Anyway, let's get back to the thing. The point is, you and I start to suffer from a set of symptoms because our drinking increases more and more and more and more, just like that. Now, whenever a person takes a foreign substance into his body and builds up a tolerance to it, the same is true of heroin, the same is true of morphine, the same is true of opium, it's all the same. He requires more. Now, how are you going to get more into your body when you require more and you want the same effect that you used to get when you took less? How do you do that? Well, let's just say this is the body here, like that. I'd make it a bucket. Let's say it's a body. And let's pour into this body bucket about a half to two-thirds of an ounce of whiskey per hour. And, or, let's pour in here 8 ounces of beer per hour, you wouldn't get drunk. Now, anybody who takes a half ounce of whiskey or 8 ounces of beer in his body won't get drunk. Now, if anybody in this audience is stupid enough to go out and try this, he will pretty soon discover, what good is 8 ounces of beer per hour? You know? What do you do with that? You know. What good is a half an ounce of whiskey? Imagine a half jigger of whiskey per hour. So pretty soon, you know, anybody who wants to go out and go ahead and try it if you want to. Let's suppose you go out and pretty soon you're going to be drinking 3 ounces per hour rather than a half ounce. At least only 2.5 ounces will be involved in getting you drunk because your body burns up a half an ounce per hour. So I don't advise you to try this. But the alcoholic, then, whose tolerance is high, to get the same effect, he needs a fluid level in his body. He's got to get more into this body of his in order to get the same effect. And one of the ways he does it is he develops one of his early symptoms of drinking, and that's known as gulping. You know, gulping. I recall one time going to New York to see a play, and there was a guy, an actor, who had come through San Francisco, went on to Broadway, and they interviewed him. Payne Knickerbocker interviewed him for the Chronicle, and he said that at one time he was an excessive drinker. He was an alcoholic. He no longer drank. He didn't say he was an AA or not. But that he was going back to Broadway to play a part in a play of an alcoholic. So I thought, well, I'm going to be back in New York. I'll get some tickets and I'll go see the play. And I did, just to see how he functioned as a drunk, now sober, playing the part of a drunk on the stage. So he came out in the first act, and he had the bottle with him, and he was drunk at the time, acting drunk. And he poured out some of the stage whiskey into a bottle, opened his big fat yap, and knocked it down. I said, that's my boy. I could tell this guy knew how to open his big throat and take a glass and just let it all fall. I almost hear it, boom, as he hit the bottom of his stomach. He knew how to gulp. This fella had utilized this mechanism to increase like that. Now, there's another thing. Most alcoholics, as we see here, alcoholics who literally have money, have assets, or some money or assets, you know, they're not lying on Skid Row at all. So they usually have people around their house and they will make the drinks. The alcoholic is always at the source of booze. He's a very benevolent servant of those that are there and likes to bring them drinks, you see. Very devoted along these lines. He'll be out in the kitchen, he'll make a tray full of drinks for the company that's in the living room. His is always a little stronger, and then he takes the tray into the group, and of course he's got the strongest drink. But if his tolerance gets high enough, that doesn't last him. How does he get out there to get some more without making it obvious? You know, so he gets out there, And one day he discovers, well, even making my own drink heavy, it doesn't do the trick. Then he finds a little glass that usually is a jelly glass, the kind that if you drop it in the floor, it won't break, you know. It's small, it'll hold about 3 or 4 ounces. You can hide it behind a plate. So he takes this down from the shelf, and as he's got all the drinks made in the tray, and his is there, the heaviest of all, he then pours out 2 or 3 ounces, or an ounce, or whatever it is, and knocks that off and puts this glass behind the plate, then takes the tray of drinks into the living room, see? Now, this is fine until one day he's out here making the drinks, you see, and his is on there, the strongest. He reaches up for his glass, and he takes the bottle, and he's just about to pour it full, and he does so, and is about to knock it off, when a non-alcoholic walks in and says to him, "What are you doing that for? You've got a drink on the tray." And the alcoholic says, I don't know. It just kind of seemed like a good idea somehow. Well, he deduces that he is in the enemy camp, you see. And that if you're going to do this, you got to develop a maneuver by which you can do this. So the next time he's out there in the kitchen, he's making the drinks. You know, he's a little nervous by this time. His is very strong. He's got to have the extra drink, but he's got to gulp it down and get into his body. So what he does, he looks in the living room. No one's coming. Comes back in, gets the glass, fills it, knocks it off, and then takes the tray, and then goes on. You see, like this. The trick is to do this and not get caught off in this damn cord. That's the point. The trick is to do this and not get caught. And that's known as sneaking drink. Now, if you were to take this whole thing here, let's just say, we'll kind of move things around here a little bit. Let's say this is ether, you know, ordinary surgical ether, the kind that we don't usually use these days. Other anesthetics are available, which are somewhat more appropriate. But nonetheless, you're all acquainted with ether. And if we take ether, and if in a chemical way we add a molecule of water, H2O, and under appropriate chemical circumstances, you would then have alcohol. Now, by converting ether to alcohol, by adding appropriate amount of water under specific chemical circumstances, you then decrease the anesthetic effect of ether. Now you have alcohol. And alcohol is about only 1/4 the anesthetic of ether, but nonetheless, it's an anesthetic. Well, if this guy is taking more and more and more and more and more and more and more alcohol in his body each day, he's more and more and more and more and more and more taking an anesthetic into his body each day. And the way anesthesia works is usually to put asleep what we call the frontal lobes of the brain, where consciousness is located. And so that a person then is in the state of what we call a blackout. Now, this is a lot different than passing out. You know, the non-alcoholic would, doesn't have blackouts usually, because the non-alcoholic gets sick and vomits, you know, all over the floor. The alcoholic may get sick and vomit, but not until the next morning. You know, Jack Bailey, you know, still, you know, our old friend in AA, every time you see him, he just heckles you. You say, "How are you, Jack?" "I've been vomiting all morning." You know, he hasn't been vomiting at all. But he just says it because he used to say it all the time. Still says it just for a gag. You know, I've been sick from vomiting all morning. But nonetheless, the alcoholic doesn't get sick before he has a lot into his body, and so he blacks out. And this is when he is on his feet, or what's jokingly referred to as being on his feet. And so blackout. Now, these are the early symptoms. They may not occur in this order, but something like this. This is known then as toxic dependent drinking, forget this, with slipping control. Now, slipping control means that when the alcoholic takes a drink into his body, it is not guaranteed that he will remember to stop. He cannot guarantee himself that once he takes a drink or two, that he will recall to mind that it's time to stop. I recall I've been sober, what, 10 years, I guess, and I was at the family club in San Francisco with several physician friends of mine, and they were sitting down playing dominoes. I never quite understood dominoes. They sit there, maybe some of you folks like dominoes. I would watch them. Anyway, this guy was sitting there, and he had two old fashions. Well, at this particular club, they made old fashions, the kind that you could take a bath in, those great big things. And I recall he took two of these drinks, and I kind of got in the spirit of each swallow. I would see him, I kind of get in the spirit, he'd take one, and I would wait for him to take another, and he'd take another. I kind of got hypnotized by this. And then he twisted my head by saying to the waiter who came up to him, "Would you like another one, doctor?" And he said, "Oh, no, I've had enough." And I thought, how do you say that? But nonetheless, he had said it. But you see, he was a non-alcoholic. He knew when to stop. His control was still there. There's one thing that the alcoholic knows about booze, and that's how to drink it badly. We understand this very well, how to drink booze badly. So the more the drinker drinks, the more he forgets the mechanism of why to stop. Now, pretty soon, the alcoholic starts to get drunk at the most inappropriate time. Inappropriate drunkenness, D. This is the boss is coming over that evening, and the alcoholic says to himself, "Gee, this is kind of important, this meeting. The boss and his wife are coming over. They haven't been here before. And so I've noticed that I drink a little more than I usually do." He has no concept that he's really an early alcoholism. He doesn't know this. And he says, "I won't drink tonight." And then he says, "Oh, no, I won't be that cruel to myself. I'll just have a couple of drinks." Now, the couple of drinks, all of us as physicians know that the alcoholic can come in just stoned, to the emergency ward or the hospital, and he just can hardly walk. How much have you had to drink? "Oh, just a couple," you say. "Maybe it's a couple of quarts, I don't know." But I remember Clark Billingsley was a guy that was at my first AA meeting, and Clark is a very wonderful bird. He's a butcher, used to be in Marin County, and now lives up in Carson City. He used to drink, he never missed any work, but he stayed drunk all the time. He would come home at night after having consumed, better part of a fifth at work. I don't know how he kept from cutting his thumbs off or his fingers, but he didn't do it. And then he would buy a little Mickey or a half pint, and he would, just before he got to the door, he would open the cork and take two drinks, pop in the cork, and put it back in his coat. Then he would walk up the stairs and come in the door. His wife, Jane, was waiting for him. She'd rush to the door, grab him by the coat, pull him into the room, and smell and say, "Clark, you've been drinking again." And he said, "No, I haven't. I've just had a couple of drinks." And he was right. He had just had a couple of drinks. Well, it's this the alcoholic said, "I'll just have a couple of drinks." And because his control has slipped a little bit, he will then go on and forget that he said he's going to have two drinks and wake in the next morning from a blackout and think, "Oh, my God, what did I do?" And it's worse when he finds out what he did do, to the boss or the boss's wife or, And about this time, he wonders what's happening to him. He's gulping drinks and having to sneak drinks and half the time can't remember what happened to him. And if he isn't blacked out, he's browned out, And he's getting drunk at the wrong time. So he starts to get frightened. And he gets the whips and jingles, the shakes and the sweat. There's a story about a very famous jazz guitar player and a jazz clarinetist who were in New York, both alcoholics, both trying to get a morning drink down to quiet down the shakes and the sweat. They're in a bar, and they would pick up their glass, and the closer they got it, the more they would do like this, and would spill all over the bar, you know, and they'd drop the glass. And, you know, bartenders are really very kind, you know. He'd wipe up the bar, and then take the glass and fill it again, and once again, the fellow tried to get up and drop it. Well, a lot of slop all over the bar, you know. About this time, a non-alcoholic came in and observed this rather remarkable performance. And after watching this spilling, you know, and the bartender patiently and in a very friendly way wiping up the bar, the non-alcoholic said to the two alcoholics, "What business are you two men engaged in?" And in typical resentful fashion, the guitar player looked up at this joker and said, "I'm a watchmaker, my friend's a brain surgeon." You know, here they are just doing this kind of stuff, you know, shaking all over the place, you know. So the shakes and the sweat. The shakes and the sweat. And, you know, there's a golden way to quiet down the shakes and sweat, and that is a shot of booze. No tranquilizer, no sedatives of the chemical kind, like secanol or nembutal or barbitol or chlorhydride or that sort of thing, will quiet down the shakes and sweat like several belts of booze. This is just, you know, it all of a sudden, well, about this time, too, the alcoholic is getting filled full of a lot of remorse, you know. He finds he's doing terrible things at work and to his wife and to the boss, and he gets filled full of this black remorse. He's shaking and he's sweating, and he then discovers that if he takes a drink, that everything gets all right. All that remorse disappears, the shakes disappear, his skin dries up, he's not perspiring, he suddenly can write all the books that he said he was going to write, he can perform all of the things that he dreamed that he was going to perform, and he's just cross-eyed with booze and life is fine. Now, it'd be just great if he could stay this way. The only thing is that booze turns a person off. And so finally he gets so much that he just goes on and goes to sleep. When he finally wakes up, there's the remorse back again. There's the shakes and sweat. So the repetitive morning drink, I'll put down here AMD, morning drinking. Now, there are many alcoholics, by the way, who have never taken a drink in the morning in their lives. Many, but most of us have done this, drinking in the morning to quiet down the shakes and the sweat. Now, remember Jack Irving, who was the central secretary in San Francisco, said that he always bought two kinds of whiskey. One was a rather cheap whiskey, and one was a rather good whiskey. He had some money in those days when he was drinking. And the reason he bought the cheap whiskey was that when he tried to drink in the morning, he'd drink one down and pop right back up again. He'd take one and pop right back up again. Pop right back up again. He said, "Why waste a good booze popping it back up again?" But once he got one or two to stick, then he would cork that bottle and take out the good, you know, and then he would start, so, morning drink. Now, the alcoholic gets so that he rationalizes why he drinks. You know, you might say, "Aren't you drinking more than you used to?" One says to the alcoholic, and he says, "Yeah, I'm tough, but I can take it, baby." Or the woman said, "I may be small, brother, but I'm potent," you know, that kind of stuff, you know, you rationalize why we do it. Now, if you're to take alcohol, let's bring that alcohol, that A, down here. That's the same A there as there. And let's add to alcohol now, in appropriate amounts, carbon dioxide, CO2, as part of the gas that we exhale. I just blew some CO2 all over you, that's CO2. A, alcohol plus CO2 in an appropriate chemical amount, and you get table sugar. In other words, ether and table sugar and alcohol are fundamentally identical, except for very minor differences. Well, here's this guy drinking more and more and more and more, and make no bones about it. the alcoholic has to have more booze every day that he continues to drink. No question. He becomes victimized. I don't care how it starts, whether he's a fool or he's a nervous upset or he's got an X factor of a physical difference. It doesn't matter how it starts. All alcoholics, everyone eventually become victimized by a true physical process and need for more booze in order to get the relief that they're asking for. Well, as a guy is drinking lots and lots and lots of booze, he's taking in lots and lots and lots of sugar into his body. No protein, no fat, no vitamin equivalents, no minerals. So as a result, he gets into malnutrition. Well, you know, this malnutrition can be a big added burden to carry. Let's just take vitamin B2 deficiency. Vitamin B2 deficiency is weeping at the drop of a hat, a sense of impending doom, a sense of impending disaster. Now, we all feel wondrous about the future. All of us cry. Anybody here don't cry? Anybody doesn't cry? So everybody cries. That's all I was going to say. If you didn't, just beat on him until he cried, because, you know, you alcoholics have to cry. We're a bunch. Anyone ever see Chuck Chamberlain? Ever hear Chuck Chamberlain talk? Cries all the time, right up in the stage, just crying, tears running down all over the stage, slobbering all over the stage, just loving everything he's saying. You know, he's great. So vitamin B2, so we all have that, but this is of the dynamics are totally different, you know. Then the alcoholic undergoes an enormous change, and that is he senses that he's different. Something's cockeyed. There's something wrong with him. He senses that the world is after him, you know. You know, gulping and sneaking and blacking out and getting drunk at the wrong time and shakes and sweats and remorse and drinking in the morning and vomiting half of those up, you know. And he's under, doesn't know he's undernourished, but he is and can't eat. And alcohol suppresses the appetite, by the way. It suppresses the appetite. Ordinarily, a person awakens with a low blood sugar, eats some breakfast, up goes the blood sugar. Just before noon, it drops off. Then a hunger comes. Eats some lunch, drops off again towards dinner time, eats dinner, and up goes the blood sugar, and by bedtime is dropping off again. This is a triphasic curve of low blood sugar in all people. And the alcoholic, it tends to go lower each time, that's true. But alcohol somehow suppresses the whole thing, so the alcoholic isn't hungry. He just has a flat curve. He just doesn't, that makes his, it makes his malnutrition even worse. He doesn't eat much. And then there's what's known as a chuck horror. Some alcoholics, you know, will sober up, and after 2 or 3 days, hunger will come back in a rush. Then they go to the refrigerator and they strip it from top to bottom, eat everything that's there, you know, the whole thing. Well, they get bloated and, you know, all messed up. So the author says, something has me in its grip, he says, way out here in the fringe of awareness. And he's all, so he feels that he's different. Well, no one, and he gets resentful. You know, the resentment that occurs to us when we become toxic on alcohol defies description. Now, all people get resentful, no question about it. Sometimes in AA, we go around trying to convince ourselves we aren't resentful, but if you're trying to convince yourself you aren't resentful, you're cockeyed because you're just resentful as hell. You know that. Hate everything around you half the time. You know that. Alcoholics weren't made for this world. Alcoholics are out of step from this world. Alcoholics are crazy. You know what we ought to do is have a course in AA, and that's how to be crazy. I think we ought to teach people how to be a little nutty. You know, this would help alcoholics a great deal. We're all crazy anyway, you know. We learn how to live without booze, but we have to be around our own kind because we're out of step with the ordinary world. Now, we go along with it all right. We go along with the ordinary world, but look inside of your own heart. Don't you feel kind of out of step a little bit, not quite in the mainstream of life, even though you convince yourself you're in the mainstream of life? Don't kid me. I know you do. Anyway, about this time, this alcoholic develops a series of toxic symptoms, and one of them is this deep resentment. My gosh, no wonder that the medical profession hates to take alcoholics into a hospital, because they go in, they're so resentful at being different that they say they just take the place apart. Well, we have now new detoxifying centers which can quiet down the alcoholic with certain kinds of intravenous fluids and within 15 minutes. So most hospitals, are they setting up these detoxifying wards. Alcoholics can be taken care of very fine, and once they're sober, then they're just great in the hospital. Go around doing everything, you know. They'll want to be the nurse. They want to carry things down to the laboratory. They want to carry trays for the nurse. You know, they're round out there with a, you know, they don't keep their gowns pulled together, working them, mopping the floors. They're just ideal patients, you know. They do everything. They do 15 things at once and get mad because the nurse takes away that duty and gives it to somebody else. They could do it 15 things at once in the hospital. So when they first came in, they're resentful because they're being there. All of a sudden, you can't get them out of the place. Then they get, you know, another toxic symptom is a symptom that literally, virtually attracts every alcoholic almost like a magnet. And it's something that everybody has, but the texture of this symptom in the active drinker is different than the same symptom is in the non-drinker. It's a symptom that's almost like it was honey. It's, the alcoholic pours it all over his head and rubs it into his skin and all over his body. He just loves to lick it, and it's known as self-pity. He loves this, you know. I recall as I was, he just loves it, you know, just loves it. If I can just have a half an hour of self-pity, and, you know, the alcoholic will say to himself, gee, here I am pitying, or, you know, the sober alcoholic will say, here I am pitying myself. I should say the serenity prayer so I get out of it. And then he says, but if I say the serenity prayer, I will get out of it. Let me have this just a little longer. So he grooves on a little self-pity a little bit longer, and that's fine. Anybody here that likes self-pity, so do I. Don't get rid of it. Just have a little more fun with it. Rub it in your hair a little bit more. It's all right. Everybody else is doing it. The guy next to you is doing it just like you're doing it. Don't let him kid you. He isn't saying the serenity prayer either. He isn't saying that. He thinks he's off the program just like you do. You know, it's the same thing. Well, anyway, so he gets all this. I remember when I was drinking, I remember at the Peacock Cork when Anson Weeks years ago in the 30s was there. And I remember I was... The Peacock Court, I don't know if you recall, the dance band was here, and then there was a big dance floor out here, and there was one row of tables down that side, many of them in the back, and there were two rows of tables down this side of the dance floor, and here at the Peacock Court were the great big windows overlooking San Francisco. I love to get at this table right near the orchestra, one table away near the window, and sit with two drinks lined up, or three, and one of them with my knees crossed, smoking a cigarette, looking out the window with half-closed eyes and sunken shoulders, dreaming of the fact that the dancers were looking over at me saying, my, look at that poor, lonely man. Just loving this whole thing, you know. Or, you know, the alcoholic gets the strange idea that he's kind of better than others. The definition of anxiety is loss of self-respect. Now, when the self-respect is lost, the only thing that an individual can do in self-defense is to decide that he's better than others, and he does this rather well. You know, the alcoholic will briskly walk into a bar and sit down on a bar stool and quickly take notice of the man or the woman. Let's say it's two men, and one of these right and one of these left. He'll say, well, I suppose he's just a beginning apprentice carpenter. And the guy to his left is only a beginning apprentice plumber. But as our drinker friend looks into the mirror, he sees Einstein sitting between the two, you know. And after some drinking, he finally falls off the stool with his head in the cuspidor, and the supposed apprentice plumber and apprentice carpenter say, there goes old Joe again. You know, we get the feeling of that we are godlike. You know, it's been said, the alcoholic says to himself, I understand that there's a second coming of Christ, and I wonder. You know. Now, you know,
you got yourself happening here. Here's a guy, because of this mess in his body here, which we don't thoroughly understand, we could go into a lot about this X factor, starts to drink, gives him tremendous relief, he goes back to alcohol quicker, he's building up a continual tolerance, he's got to drink more and more and more to get the same effect, and as a result, he gets a series of symptoms. Here you got a guy or a gal who is gulping drinks or sneaking drinks, blacking out all over the place, can't tell the time of day because they've been blacked out for several days, or, you know, getting drunk at the wrong time. Every morning they're shaking and they're sweating, they're filled full of remorse, they're gulping down booze, and half which they pop up in the morning, rationalizing why, they're undernourished, filled full of resentment, filled full of self-pity, and think they're Jesus Christ. Now, you got something. You got something here. And if you think that's not a true physical disease with some emotional toxicity, you're crazy. This guy, you know, there are lots of things. Then there's the geographical cure, you know. The person will decide, well, I'm burning you up there. He will decide, I'll start walking around this way. That's what I'm going to do.
Okay, it'll last.
All right. He'll say, well, who wouldn't drink in the East Bay? After all, it's sea level. Who wouldn't get drunk all the time? So he decides that what he'll do is to go to Denver, because there it's high and dry. The thing he's forgotten is that he takes himself with him. He gets up to Denver, and he gets just as drunk. So I guess I made a mistake. It isn't the high, dry time. What I need is the sea level, but where it's not quite as foggy. So I'll go to Long Beach. You know, who wouldn't drink at a high, dry level or a low level after fog? But down in Long Beach, I won't. He goes down and he gets just as drunk. So he gets on this geographical cure, and this just never works. Geographical cure. And then there's a lot of stuff. He starts to make all kinds of alibis as to why he's drinking, because he's starting to lose some job. This is toxic, dependent drinking without control. Now, this isn't quite true, because the alcoholic has some control, even to the very end. The lowest of alcoholics has some control. And down here is the 3% of people, and this is the stage of true addiction. And we can dispense with this rather quickly. Here, R-O-H, I'll put down. That means alcohol, chemical way of saying it. And here, that's the only thing the alcoholic now, at this stage, wants. No longer saving face. Job, wife, family, all gone. He just wants booze. At this particular time, he also is ending up in jails and hospitals. Well, for that matter, he may get into jails and hospitals here or here, but it's for sure he gets into repeated arrest here for drinking. Finally, cirrhosis of the liver, finally, Korsakoff syndrome, and finally, death. That's the path the alcoholic goes in that fashion, down like that, throughout his drinking career. Now, we can put this in another way, which might make it a little bit clearer. This whole physical process and what happens to the alcoholic. Let's just say that this parallelogram, like that, this is normal drinking, and this is abnormal drinking here. And let's just say that these are all the symptoms of alcoholism, beginning with gulping, sneaking, blackouts, inappropriate drunkenness, shakes and sweats, remorse, morning sweat, all the way down to finally death on that scale. Now, the alcoholic can be drinking, let's say, here. That's about at this point here on that scale. Well, let's say 15%. Of his drinking is, well, I got these mixed up. This would be abnormal drinking, and this would be normal down here. 15% of his drinking is abnormal, but 85% of the time, he can drink almost like a so-called social drinker, you know. Well, let's say he gets to here, where 50% of his drinking is abnormal, and 50% is now still normal. He's maybe down here. Well, half the time, this guy can drink as though he were perfectly all right. Then let's say a perfectly social drinker. Down on Skid Row, 95% of the drinking is abnormal. 5% is still normal. In other words, he's got time, enough control to stay away from booze long enough to bum a dime for a jug of Muscatel wine, that sort of thing. The point is that the progress of drinking is always in that direction once a person has started with symptoms. You know, we find people sometimes in alcoholic referral centers or at AA meetings that say, well, I've only got a few symptoms up here. I'm not like you fellas. I don't drink like you do. I don't have all the trouble you've had. You can always say to this person, very benevolently, you can always say, have hope, you will have. This is a progressive disease. Now, this box here that I drew is a way of saying that it takes about 15 years of drinking before the first symptom in this blackboard, gulping, starts. Roughly then, the degree of alcoholism in 1970 reflects that drinking that started in 1955. It takes about 15 years. Now, there are many of you in this audience who, after 1 month, 1 day, or 1 year of drinking, were in trouble. I know that. There are some of you here who were able to drink 25 years before you got into serious trouble, but the average is about 15 years. The point of this whole thing is that once you get to this point where the first symptom of alcoholism appears and you go across this elusive line, there is no return. As far as we know, there is no going back to any kind of controlled drinking. As long as you continue to drink, you'll continue to go down this scale or down this scale, down there. There's no going back because irreversible physical processes occur which, as far as we know today, make it impossible to return to controlled drinking, if indeed we were ever controlled. Now, this is how we slowly lose control of our drinking, by exposing ourselves more and more and more to it. Plus the fact we're a sitting duck for it because of the X factor that's in our body. But once we have developed the disease of alcoholism, one has drunk up one's right to drink again and still stay out of trouble. As far as we know, it can't be done. And maybe one day, the big book even says this, we may develop a pill or a shot which will make it possible to go back to drinking. I can't imagine why, really. What's the point? Because the alcoholic needs something different. The alcoholic, my wife and I were talking about this morning. Now, I'm talking to just the drunks here. For any non-alcoholics here, you don't have to pay any attention to what I'm saying. The alcoholic desperately needs, desperately, his life depends on it. He desperately needs, and I'm going to use words which will kind of turn to ashes in my mouth, because once you say them, they lose their impact. Desperately needs a sense of contact with some mysterious source, something that's far greater than he. He needs a sense of wonder. He needs a sense of awe. He needs a sense of feeling that there's something else going on in this great, magnificent universe. He needs a sense of out there. That, hey, there's something that's out there. Now, some people find this in the Baptist church. Some people find it in the synagogue. Some find it in a church. Some find it in other places. It doesn't make any difference where one finds it. But it's for sure the drunk desperately, oh, so ever desperately, needs a sense of contact with something that is, he can latch onto and fly. Baby, fly with me. The drunk is saying that to everybody. Baby, won't you fly with me, you know, somewhere, up into out there, and at the same time, keep one foot on the ground. That sort of a thing. Well, now, don't you know that 35 years ago,
the boss of all came to two guys and said, I need some help. And this help is in some way to replace these symptoms with a new way of living. And this is how AA got started. He said this to a disreputable stock and bond broker. He said it to a disreputable physician, both in different parts of the Eastern Coast. He said, I want you to go out and I want you to organize all the drunks you can get a hold of. I want you to bring them together, and I want you to start an organization which will be the greatest organization in the entire world. I want you to go out and I want you to preach to all of them by telling them what's happened to you. Your story, so that they'll come and join you, and you will become known as the greatest spiritual movement of the age. I want you to go out and I want you to do all this so that educational systems will be altered by what you do. So that the medical profession will learn from you what they can't learn elsewhere. I want you to become the greatest organization that ever existed. But you two drunken bums, let me say something to you. To the degree that you think your organization is the greatest, to the degree that you brag that you're the greatest spiritual movement of the age, to the degree that you think you are changing education and politics and the hearts and souls of this nation and brag about that, to that degree you'll get drunk again. The only thing I want you to do is to go out and pick up those drunks and bring them here. And these two drunken guys, the doctor and the stockbroker, said to the boss of all, what are you talking about? Why don't you get men of substance? Look, they're a great statesman. They're a great politician. There are great religious leaders. There are great doctors. Why don't you ask them to do this? We've lost everything. We're on our uppers. We don't know anything about getting people together. And the great boss of all said to these two guys, listen, jokers, if I had wanted these great statesmen and these great doctors, don't kid yourself, I could have obtained them. I want you because you're nothing. You're nothing except you're everything because you've been there. I want you because you know what it's like to die over and over and over and over again. You know what it's like to feel absolutely separate from everybody. You know what it's like to have your heart thoroughly cracked. You know what it's like to feel desolate. You know what it's like to feel without a soul. You know what it's like to pray that you'll die the next minute. All of these things you understand. Yeah, you're not very verbal. You don't know much about writing. You're not scholar. But you've been places, and that's the kind of a guy, and that's the kind of a group that I want, composed of the worthless nothing, who actually are the golden everythings of the world, as are all people. But in your instance, you're going to concentrate on the drunk. So these two guys decided they would accept this challenge. And so they set out a series of principles by which they would function. And these principles were known as AA. And what they did was to fill the big gap in their lives and their members' lives that had come along
which were now empty because they stopped drinking. And they said, we admitted that we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Came to believe, said they to their new members, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity, desperately needing some kind of spiritual awe. Made a decision, they put down as number three, to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. Not as you understand him, by the way, Mr. Priest or Mr. Rabbi or Mr. Minister, the way I understand him. God as I understand him. Don't tell me who God is. I'll tell you who I think he is. Made a fearless and searching moral, or maybe you could say morale, inventory of ourselves. And then admitted to God and to ourselves and to another human being the exact nature of where we had gone cockeyed, where we were wrong. And then as a sixth step said, we're entirely ready to have God, as mentioned in the second and third steps, remove all of our, not too well phrased, but defects of character, where we've gone off the beam from our spiritual demand, the craving. The drunk craves booze, but it's nothing in comparison to his craving for a spiritual thing. He's got to have it. He has to have it. Cannot get along without it for any length of time. Step seven, humbly ask him to remove our shortcomings. Oh, God, please do something. Because I can't do it somehow. Show me the way in some way. Eight, made a list of all persons that we had harmed as we were doing all this godlike stuff. and became willing to make amends to them all. Nine, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. Let's don't continue hurting people if we can avoid it. Step 10, continue to take a personal inventory, and when we were wrong, or for that matter, when we were right, promptly admitted it. Step 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood it, praying only for the knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. And step 12, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these past 11 steps, we tried to carry this little dumb, stupid message to other alcoholics, and to emphasize the point, we tried to practice these principles in all of our affairs. Well, these two crazy guys, one in New York and one in Akron, travel the country collecting the drunks all over the place. Until now, we measure about 400,000 in number who know something about dying, something about broken hearts, something about desolation, something about ecstasy, and certainly know something about the loss of heart and soul and the deep need to have some meaning put into our lives by associating with other people. Now, it's a crazy, crazy, crazy thing that you get a bunch of people like this together and we all stay sober, pretty much. Not everybody, but pretty much everybody stays sober. Now, this was crazy, you know. It's a strange thing. You know, most of us, now this place is an exception, of course, but most of us have meetings in meeting places that we wouldn't ordinarily, in our drinking days, be found dead in. You know, smoke-filled old shack someplace, you know, or somebody's living room or kitchen. It's crazy, you know, to be in that kind of a thing. And you know, you get around an AA meeting, you know, you've got seven people around in a circle, and they're all carrying on a conversation that's different from everybody else, and every conversation is beginning with the word I. And yet these crazy, idealistic, resentful, you know, easily angered, touchy, sensitive individuals who have a deep meaning, who fire at one another, who just hate one another at times, embrace one another at times, they get together and shoot off their great big faces, they don't say anything, it's a bunch of junk, and they all stay sober. Now, how do you do that? When here you've had the great religionists of the world, you know, the God, they prayed over us and about us and behind us and back of us and front of us to stay sober, and barring rare exceptions, the drunk hasn't stayed sober, even these great men who have the cloth who have given of their lives, or the great physicians. You know, we couldn't get along without the doctors, you know. And yet the great doctors have not been able to give us a lasting sobriety of the kind that we absolutely have to have. Can't get along without it. You know, and the psychiatrists, you know, God Almighty, you know, they analyze us inside and outside and learn all about us, and they help us in many ways, and we go out and get drunk again. Then, you know, the great psychiatry is a great adjunct to Alcoholics Anonymous. And it makes medical sense to me that if you as a drinker went to a psychiatrist and ironed out all of your past trouble, if that caused your drinking, that then you'd be able to drink again. Why not? Your troubles are ironed out and handled. The only thing is, it doesn't work. It just doesn't work. Self-understanding is not, ain't where it's at, somehow. Now, how do you account for all this? The people, look at right here. I look around here, I see you looking at me smiling, I see you looking at me smiling, and I see you with your eyes fixed on me. And everyone, right this minute, as I look down here at your faces, you're all just like this, and the place is kind of silent. Listen. No one but some joker coughing. That's a drunk, you see. That's all. He broke the silence. You know, he got resentful all of a sudden, had to break the silence. You know, hated everything. Well, I don't know how you explain this that happens, but I know it appeals to the yearning that's so deep it's immeasurable to get a sense of a higher power. We come to find that our well of love is so deep you can't measure it, that our reach is so long that you can't measure it. Now, I suppose that the doctors would say what occurs at these cockeyed meetings, all these resentful idealistics, is psychosomatic medicine or benevolent interpersonal relation. You know, and this is probably true. We're kind of benevolent even if we hate one another. Or I suppose certain ones who'd say what you have is an esprit de corps, you know, something of that sort. Or the others who would say, I suppose what you have is group psychotherapy. But oddly to me, the very thing that draws all of you crazy, crazy, nutty people into this auditorium on a beautiful Sunday afternoon, who would be caught dead in here, listen to me, shoot off my mouth, except a bunch of drunks, the thing that's in this entire air, which tends to keep you sober and cannot be described by the doctors or the statesmen or the religionists, is a sense of the presence of God. Thank you very much.